Now, especially nowadays, North Korea is often associated with threats, well known for directing its missiles at its foes and for accompanying verbal blasts of colorful rhetorics, to say the least. But when did North Korean commandos actually penetrate South Korea and come within several hundred meters of the then Blue House, and under what circumstances? How genuine was the threat, and how did South Korea respond to this very crisis? Today we'll discuss the Blue House raid of 1968, perhaps the closest Kim Il-sung ever came to Park Chung-hee with his best-trained soldiers bringing fear to South Korean citizens. To discuss all that and more, we have Professor John DeMoya from the Seoul National University joining us in the studio. Professor, good to see you once again.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for having me again.
So this is a very interesting part of Korean history, something that maybe some of the younger listeners might be going, really? Did this really happen here in South Korea? But what was South Korea's, first and foremost, before we get into all of this, what was South Korea's role in the Vietnam War? And that is, how did this function as a broad background to the Blue House attack?
Yes. As early as about 64, South Korea is negotiating with the United States in terms of its role in participating in the Vietnam War. The estimates will be that eventually South Korea I'm just looking ahead, the broad period, between 65 and 73 will commit somewhere in the range of about 320,000 troops, making South Korea the second largest contingent behind the United States. In turn, the United States will offer access to procurements, all kinds of aid. It's a win-win deal for both sides.
You scratch my back, I scratch your back.
Absolutely, a quid pro quo.
Yeah.
In the context of what we're talking about, what this does is, of course, take large numbers of South Korean troops away from the immediate home front attention, and also diverts the American attention primarily to Vietnam, which presumably is figuring in North Korean thinking in terms of both of these forces are distracted. Let's see how attentive they are.
Yeah, so basically because all these South Korean soldiers were basically in Vietnam helping out the United States.
Yeah, certainly a large, large contingent.
There was somewhat of a vulnerability when it comes to South Korea's defenses at the time.
Such was the perception, and based on the increased activity in the DMZ, looking back, that seems to have been what was going on. Was there a number of probes were done?
You know, what's interesting is we talk about the tension on the Korean Peninsula nowadays.
Sure.
Especially during, you know, the past few years under the Yoon administration, where they've been very hawkish towards North Korea. But if you look at history, there's been actual clashes. There was even more tension on the Korean Peninsula. Let's talk about what were some of the incidents that were taking place at the DMZ in the mid-1960s, and also at what kind of frequencies. How have historians treated this sort of time period between 1965 through 1969?
Sure. Retroactively, there are at least a couple hundred incidents, border probes, crossovers, each of these years, meaning that 65 through about 68, to the time of the incident we're going to talk about, has sometimes been labeled, and with caution in quotation marks, a second Korean War.
Yeah.
Not a declared crossing as happened in June 1950, but certainly the frequency with which these things happened, the actual exchange of gunfire on both sides and occasional small casualties, indicated that this was not just border guards accidentally confronting each other.
No.
This was a deliberate series of attempts to see if any provocations could be stirred into things further, probably, again, to check exactly the border strengths. And also, I don't know, in 65 through 68, I've seen earlier pictures, but it's not quite, if we could think of infrastructure, the DMZ of today with barbed wire in most places. They, however, have a couple hundred meters up to a couple kilometers of distance, and the mines and things like that. If you look at pictures, even in the early 60s, sometimes you will see much thinner strips of wire. In other words, it hadn't been built up in quite the same way, to the extent it has now. So that I suspect that also says something to do with the perceived permeability of the border was much more readily available than it is now.
And speaking of permeability, one of the things that we did talk about previously with Professor Engel last year was all the tunnels that they discovered.
Oh, yeah.
And so, I mean, they've only discovered a handful, but, you know, who knows how many other tunnels are still in existence that were never discovered, and how many are they planned to use, maybe. But the fact that they're able to create these tunnels so that they could mobilize troops, maybe.
Precisely. That is the goal, is that you could mobilize a couple hundred to maybe even, I don't know, because I don't know how wide the tunnels are. But certainly, right, that you would, and then you would be several hundred meters into the territory already having gotten past the initial guards. Right. So, exactly.
So let's talk about why the North Korean commandos were dispatched and what they hoped to actually accomplish out of all of this.
Sure. This at least is fairly well documented. Somewhere in late December, early January 1968, roughly 31 North Korean commandos who have been training for this are dispatched. They are dispatched specifically to get to the Blue House, specifically with the mission of confronting and assassinating Park Chung-hee. And interesting, and this is, as you suggested earlier, probably surprising to younger learners, they do get, I think, somewhere within a couple hundred meters. They get really, really close. My understanding is that on the evening of, I think it's January 16th, someone confronts them. This is when they're not quite, because the eventual incident is going to be like the 20th or the 21st.
Yeah.
But someone confronts them and kind of questions them and feels enough that these guys are a little bit off, so reports something to the police. The police now know that probably someone they should be checking out is within a couple hundred kilometers of the area, probably somewhere in the Seoul area. When they actually get to the so-called raid, and again, I think it's the 21st, I'd have to check, but what they get is within several hundred meters of the Blue House, they confront the policeman who is now, I imagine, regarded as a South Korean hero. Who basically questions them and says, kind of like, who goes there? Who are you guys? And he realizes, and that's where gunfire breaks out. I believe the two South Korean policemen who were there are killed. Ultimately, of the 31 North Koreans, it's 29 are killed. Of the two remaining, one gets back to North Korea and one is captured. And I imagine through a lot of this information filters out through talking to the captured guy, talking to the people who had seen the initial group a couple days earlier. And they can piece together that this was, in fact, a concerted effort to get there. And as I said, given that that policeman was within, you know, appointed directly to the Blue House, the South Koreans realized later that this came within, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes of actually happening.
And the crazy thing with this, I remember learning for the very first time. Again, I'm sort of late to Korean history. It's still one of the best movies I've ever watched. Uh-huh. Shinmido.
Sure.
And I watched this, I have to say, I think my freshman year in college. So back in like 2004 or...
I was going to say, it's somewhere in the early 2000s.
Yeah, and so I remember watching this. And, you know, one of the first scenes of the movie is the actual Blue House raid, right? And you see the North Korean commandos going there and then, you know, they're all moving and then choom, 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 and the lights go off. And then, you know, and then one of the reasons for why they say that they failed is because they just couldn't, you know, move quick enough and things like that and whatever. And I was going, wait a minute, this movie's based on a true story. Did this really happen?
Yeah.
It's something that's so imaginable.
I believe there's still a little sign. I haven't seen it in years, but I believe there's a sign near Cheongwon-dae that is right. Allegedly where the policeman first found them and confronted them. And it was within like 200, 250 meters of the Blue House. It's very, it's when you see it, you're like, wait a minute. So they were basically within, again, a short walk.
I mean, you could think about historically all the little things that could have happened. So let's talk about, before we talk about what could have happened, what happened during the actual raid and with what results and consequences, and how did Park Chung-hee end up choosing to mobilize this to the public?
Okay. During the actual raid, as I suggested, there is an exchange of gunfire. How those 29 of the 31 North Koreans are killed, I don't imagine it's in the initial, because I said I believe the two South Korean policemen are killed.
Yeah.
But I guess in the process of quickly realizing the alarm is going out, we have to move out. Most of the North Koreans will be killed off. My also understanding is that in the process of the South Korean police looking for them over the next couple of days to weeks, you get somewhere in the range of, it's under 100, but you get some other South Korean troops or policemen killed. You get some civilians killed. Again, probably all in the process of figuring out what's going on. I imagine a lot of chaos. No one really knows what's going on. Two really quick things in terms of mobilizing this to the public. One, and I've actually never checked this, I really should, but I imagine there's some kind of broadcast, you know, some sort of an immediate kind of alert to let people know what's going on, but it's relatively safe. But in terms of immediate, and I think this was both practical but also strategic, this is the alleged base for the Yebikun or Home Reserve Army. The idea that, by the way, if we're sending our troops overseas, we actually really need to be paying attention at home.
Right.
So I always joke to my male students who even now, as you know, continue to do Yebikun duty, I'm like, you do realize there's an actual route to this and this comes from a particular set of incidents. And at least, again, in that context, very pragmatic. But it also is symbolic in terms of you get the home front mobilized, you get people behind you. And even just to give you a quick version of it where it still resonates in the mind, it was last year, October 22, when I went to a Peace Corps reunion dinner. And some of these were early 60s, mid-60s Peace Corps guys.
Right.
If the first group is 66. So when they took us to dinner somewhere behind Chongwade, which as you now know is much more opened up, these guys who hadn't been back in country in a long time were like, that's exactly what came up. They were like, isn't this kind of where the raid occurred?
And are we allowed
back here? Is this legal? And they were like, no. Chongwade is a very different place now, a very different space.
So it's not a presidential office anymore.
No.
It's a touristy area now.
Precisely. And again, it was nice to see these older kind of people coming back in their, I guess most of them in their early 60s, kind of going like okay, so we're good, we're allowed to go here.
And the other thing that, again, going back to the movie Shinmido, right, mm-hmm, again, named after the island where apparently
the training took place, I imagine.
These crooks, right, these criminals, the government decided they were going to do this some secretive operation where they're going to train a whole bunch of criminals who are facing death penalties and just wipe off their names, and they're going to turn them into super soldiers. And this was in response to,
right,
Kim Il-sung trying to assassinate Park Chung-hee.
It was seen as a direct reprisal, tit for tat, we're going to do the same thing you did to us. We won't use trained commandos. As you said, we'll use guys who are hardened criminals. This is how you pay your debt off. You're probably going to die, but you are essentially doing a nationalist gesture.
Yeah, or if you come out alive successful, then you're going to be, they're going to wipe out all your criminal records.
Should
and you're going to be
should
a
you
hero.
Defy all odds?
And of course, and it's probably likely that the government was going, they're not going to come out alive with this.
No, precisely. I think they know this too.
Yeah, and even if they're successful in assassinating Kim Il-sung, how are they going to come back
precisely,
and things like that? And that was the thing
precisely.
I think that wasn't planned out was they got the whole
I don't
process
think there was
of going
any,
in.
I don't think there was any extraction plan.
No, and then of course, as if anyone's seen the movie in itself, they call off the operations,
sure,
and I'm not going to talk about the rest of it. I do encourage all of our listeners out there to watch that movie.
I'll say this. It's a little bit overzealous from my perspective. I mean, from the history perspective, but it is a fun film. And as you said, it does have a strong basis in this 68 incident and then the South Korean response, which, as we know, was then covered up until...
You would have thought that, especially with a leader like Park Chung-hee, right, if there was an assassination attempt on him, and clearly the North Korean commandos getting, again, hundreds of meters away from Blue House, that it would have sparked maybe, again, a second Korean War. He talked about, technically they're still at war, but there was nothing really that happened from it except for the formation of the Yebigun or the reserves.
Right, more of a mobilization and a, wow, let's be on guard. But you're right, not a... Other than maybe putting the DMZ guys on red alert or something, there's no indication that there was any right.
As a historian, do you find that kind of surprising?
I do and I don't. I do in the sense of you're right, thinking of just like in terms of the psychology. But pragmatically speaking, and this helps us put it in the context, again, it's early 68. There are, it's not 300,000 is spread over the 8 or 10 years. So probably at any one point in time, 80 to 100,000 South Korean soldiers are in Vietnam. So you've got a deep commitment, which would make one hesitate about doing anything rash. Also, as we know, in just a couple, and here's where it gets speculative. In just a couple days, I think it's January 23rd, you get the North Korean capture of the Pueblo, which as far as we know... LBJ, of course, thought all these things were related. It's also just around the same time, and I think it's within the same week of the Tet Offensive. LBJ thinks these things are coordinated. We don't know that, but a lot of people have read, just to stick with the North Korean thing and leave out what the Vietnamese know, that the Pueblo and the Blue House incident are at least possibly related in the sense that the North Koreans may have seen some serious need. Wow, we just came really close. There's going to be blowback, as you just suggested, and then the capture of the Pueblo then might be a way of preempting any kind of immediate response.
Okay, so for our listeners out there, what's the Pueblo incident?
Sure. The Pueblo incident is an American ship that, as far as I know, was legally in international waters, but it's clearly an NSA-type spy ship, radio signals, other things, off the Korean coast. The North Koreans will capture this ship, again, within about a 48-hour period of the major part of the Blue House incident, claiming that it's in their territorial waters. They will hold, I can't remember the number, but they'll hold a number of U.S. sailors and people on the ship for a number of months in a kind of barter situation with the U.S. And that's, again, exactly why people have read this as presumably this was not accidental that it came a few days later, and this may or may not have been the North Koreans anticipating, well, just in case there's any kind of massive blowback, we'll have this. The one other thing that's really funny, just mentioning, I believe it's the Pueblo incident, when they're asked at some point several months later to show in good faith, that is the North Koreans are asked, that these sailors are healthy. Mm-hmm. This is the famous picture where they are, and I'm going to be careful here because I realize this is for radio, but they're shown, you know, healthy, but they're all shown giving a signal that most Americans realize is an offensive gesture.
Okay.
And they told the North Koreans, oh, this is like a sign of like happiness or greetings to our, and then of course the North Koreans figured this out, and later they did apparently beat the American soldiers for doing this.
Okay.
But this was their way of saying like, we're in the midst of being captured, but we're still going to defy you.
Yeah.
And it's a very famous picture.
So that's one of those things that I never, going back into why this didn't blow up into a major conflict. Because if you think about it, if something like this happened in 2024, where the North Korean commandos came close, well, I mean, it'll be difficult to go to Yongsan presidential office.
Considering that's true, the location, they might go to the wrong place. Yeah.
Maybe that's why. Maybe that's why the president moved the presidential office. No. But if, let's say, something like this happens in 2024, highly likely that, considering especially this administration, there is going to be a stronger response.
Not only that, but these days you would almost immediately have Biden and Xi and other parties talking and all surrounding immediately saying, let's talk before you guys do anything. And as you said, then the response depends on a multilateral group of people talking and trying to figure out how we address this, but how?
But I think that's one of those things that we never kind of took into consideration, because I think you just answered the question. I was wondering why you were talking about the Vietnam War.
Sure.
To start off this.
Sure.
But this is all linked, because you're right. I was always asking, why wasn't there a stronger response, especially from Park Chung-hee? But again, going back to the fact that a large number of the troops were in Vietnam.
And I don't know how this represents in terms of the overall percentage of Korean troops, but it's significant enough that they know that if they're looking back at the, as I imagine these guys do, the plans for 50, that they know if there's anything major thing that you just can't simply withdraw physically. Yeah. There's immense logistics considerations involved.
And I could probably imagine the United States basically going, listen, I know what
status
happened over
agreement.
There,
yeah.
but focus on us first. You've agreed. And so even with now going into the whole Shimido case, right, if, let's say, those criminals who now turn into super soldiers, they end up going to North Korea and they assassinate Kim Il-sung.
This also would have been problematic.
Oh, it would have sparked a war. But again, the U.S. probably knew this and go, listen, if you do that, then there's highly likely there's going to be a war. We don't have the soldiers to send you guys help. You guys also have your troops in Vietnam right now. Call it off is probably the reason, one of the main reasons, although they don't talk about this.
And I would imagine some version of that conversation takes place behind closed doors, and sure.
This all makes sense. This was a thing that kind of like, I'm always like, why
did
this happen?
Just to throw in one more thing, which now remains partly speculative. North Korea definitely supported the North Vietnamese economically and supported them in terms of morale
for
Vietnam. The question of whether there are any North Koreans in Vietnam, I've never seen anything in terms of troops, but there's now, I think, I've seen, again, sources start to pop up, things like a few pilots and things like that. So what I mean is, if the South is very actively, visibly participating in the South Vietnamese effort, the North is at least in spirit and probably economically and probably with a few pilots participating also. So they have their own commitments, which probably means that they also have their own pragmatic considerations, which mean they can't just act kind of rashly.
I do wonder, because I know historically, before North Korea conducted their invasion on June 25th, 1950, that they consulted with the Soviet Union.
Yes. I mean, I believe Mao is somehow involved in those conversations as well.
It's not one of those things where Kim Il-sung was kind of like, I'm just going to do this on their own.
No.
He was given the green light.
He at least got them to sign off, and he told them it would be a very quick, with several months, and that's why they thought that they would not have the protracted thing that happened.
Right. Do you think maybe then the Soviet Union and China also maybe were told and gave the green light to Kim Il-sung about this Blue House listening?
This I don't know. That sounds entirely plausible. Haven't looked at the sources and I don't know.
But
it's a great question to think about in terms of, it's certainly, given the prior relationships, I can't believe, and also given his commitment to North Vietnam, that there weren't some sort of signals going on that maybe I can't tell you, but there's something in the works, and if something happens, be prepared.
Because I mean, you're looking at an era where, again, the United States were willing to do anything to stop communist countries, right? I mean, you know, you have the Red Scare and things like that.
And at this, if we're talking even just specific to the incident, 68, heavily involved in Vietnam, and as we now know, quietly even involved in Laos, Cambodia will happen in 70. So, yes, all kinds of things. It's primarily visible in Southeast Asia, but yes, around the world.
And so I think it would be completely plausible that, you know, the Soviet Union and China would actually give a green light to Kim Il-sung, saying, listen, cause more uproar. I don't think anything is going to happen because of what's going on in Vietnam. And so, obviously, in history book, this is what we know. But let's talk about what kind of effects the raid had on the South Korean-North Korea relations. And are there any links anticipating the Yushin period to come again shortly, which we, by the way, covered extensively in our program with Professor Engel last year?
Yeah, no, I would imagine that definitely, use whatever words you want here, a hardening and increasing of the tensions. I imagine certainly that this leading into, although South Korea is still nominally democratic, this makes Park Chung-hee even more careful about his political goals and how to ensure that he will keep his leadership. Weirdly enough, there is that 72 summit, although I don't know how much that's just nominal and how much that's just exchange of things. But yes, in general, a ratcheting up.
And what's the 72 summit?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. What was or why?
Well, what's the 72 summit?
There's definitely some conversations between the North and South in 72 that is actually a reducing of the tensions, which is exactly presumed. I mean, if to refit the narrative, 68, an increasing of those tensions, and then a real recognition at some point, 3 or 4 years later, that perhaps we should talk and kind of calm those things down again. Yeah.
Again, one of those things where it seems like it came out straight out of a movie.
In fact, I'm. You tell me, because I'm not a film person, and you are nicely brought in the South Korean side. I'm amazed this is not depicted more in major South Korean films, just because it's so fascinating that you would have these 31 guys land somewhere and make it to the Blue House, almost.
And Professor DeMoy, you know, I have to say, I thought this was one of those things where I thought I knew, and then, you know, you broke down, you brought up the Vietnam War, and I had no idea. There is a great link to this.
No, absolutely.
I think this is the reason why there wasn't a stronger response from Park Chung-hee. And you know what? That could have potentially indirectly, the Vietnam War possibly prevented another Second Korean War because of the situation. And that's just
opinion. I hadn't thought about it, but it makes sense in that for everyone concerned, even as the North Koreans are probing, they also recognize that there are limitations and they're playing a game within constraints.
Absolutely. Professor DeMoya, this is unfortunately all the time that we have today. As always, thank you very much for your analysis in this incredible part in Korea's history. Have a safe rest of your week, and we'll see you again next week.
Thanks very much.
You can listen to Korea Now with me, SJ Lee, by downloading the Arirang Radio application or tune in online by visiting www.arirangradio.com. So make sure you tune in Mondays through Fridays, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Korea time.